Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Today is a really big day for Bristol Bay. For us to get back on track in this process is very exciting.
The EPA proposes vetoing development of the Pebble Mine. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, as COVID case numbers rise, health officials urge older Alaskans to take extra precautions.
Even if they're vaccinated and boosted, we still know that age is your number one risk factor for severe COVID illness.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency today proposed vetoing development of the Pebble Mine. That's the vast deposit of copper and gold at the headwaters of Bristol Bay. It's a big step toward permanently blocking development of the mine, which would be built in the salmon-rich Bristol Bay watershed. And it's a move opponents of the mine have pursued for more than a decade. And as KDLG's Izzy Ross reports, everyone involved is waiting on more details.
The EPA says mining the Pebble deposit would result in unacceptable losses to salmon habitat, both at the site and further downstream. That's why it says it's proposing to prohibit dredging and filling there. That could kill the proposed Pebble mine, a project that people in the region have fought over for decades. The executive director of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, Alana Hurley, opposes the mine and says the EPA's proposal is a step in the right direction.
Today is a really big day for Bristol Bay, for us to get back on track in this process and for the Biden administration to be committed to finishing the job to stop Pebble Mine once and for all is very exciting. But we're not there yet. We definitely need to get through the rest of this process.
She says that includes closely reviewing the EPA's proposal. Once the agency releases details tomorrow of exactly how it wants to restrict mining. The EPA is proposing to restrict development of the Pebble deposit using its authority under a section of the Clean Water Act, Section 404C. It's only used that authority 13 times in the Act's 50-year history. Section 404C allows the agency to veto projects that would significantly damage habitat or recreational areas. The EPA says the mine would result in the loss of almost 100 miles of stream habitat and about 8 miles of salmon habitat. It also says it would result in the loss of more than 2,000 acres of wetlands and waters at the mine site. Hurley says she hopes the EPA's proposal will become a permanent mining ban, but she says they've been this close to blocking Pebble before. In 2014, the Obama administration's EPA proposed vetoing mining of that deposit before Pebble had submitted its proposal.
At that time, the protections looked like restrictions on the Pebble deposit. As many remember, those got held up in court, and when the federal administration changed, they eventually were withdrawn.
The United Tribes of Bristol Bay and others sued the federal government and won in an appeal last year. So the Biden administration's EPA restarted its review, which resulted in the proposed mining ban. The company that wants to build the mine, Pebble Limited Partnership, called the EPA's proposal a step backwards for President Biden's climate goals. It said the administration is hindering efforts to domestically mine minerals like copper, which are used for renewable energy technologies. The company has also consistently maintained that the mine would bring employment opportunities and industry to the region, and that its proposed mine plan wouldn't cause significant harm to Bristol Bay's fishery. As for now, Pebble spokesperson Mike Heatwall says the company is waiting on the details of how the EPA proposes to restrict mining of the development.
This is state of Alaska land, and reading between the lines on the EPA's action here, it's upwards of 400 square miles of state of Alaska land that the federal government is proposing taking off the table. And, there's just a lot of details within what the EPA is proposing that really need to be scrutinized to know, kind of how it's all going to work.
Heatwall says the company will examine certain parts of the agency's proposal in particular, like whether it incorporates the Army Corps' 2020 environmental review of the project,
which are very clear in terms of both the fishery not being impacted and on the water resources as well.
Pebble Limited Partnership submitted its proposal for the mine back in 2017. It was reviewed by the Army Corps, which ultimately denied Pebble a federal permit in 2020. Pebble has appealed that decision. Public hearings on the EPA's proposal to ban the mine development will take place in June. The EPA will also accept written comments until July 5th. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Three people were critically injured in a small airplane crash near Yakutat yesterday, and a fourth was treated for minor injuries. At about 3:15 p.m., Coast Guard headquarters in Juneau received an emergency locator transmitter alert and a phone call from a Good Samaritan reporting that a single-engine de Havilland Otter had crashed. The plane went down some 30 miles outside of Yakutat in the woods near the Dry Bay airstrip. Photos by the Coast Guard show the Otter's crumpled fuselage with the wings broken off. According to Lieutenant Eric Oridson at the air station Sitka, local responders from Yakutat were first to arrive on the scene and had already begun administering medical aid when the Coast Guard arrived.
It took us about an hour and 20 minutes after takeoff to get there. We probably got there just after 5 o'clock. But there was already another aircraft that had brought emergency medical personnel from Yakutat. So they had landed at the airstrip and were on scene, and we landed after them. Two of the people, the plane that had landed first, had already been extracted from the aircraft, and they had them on backboards at the airstrip there. And there's a third person that was still in the plane.
A fourth person with minor injuries had already been taken to Yakutat by a Good Samaritan when the Coast Guard arrived. The three victims with serious injuries were medevaced aboard an Air Station Kodiak C-130 to Anchorage International Airport and transported to Providence, Alaska Medical Center and the Alaska Native Medical Center. The cause of the crash is currently under investigation. COVID-19 cases are on the rise again in the state. Health officials are encouraging Alaskans to renew their efforts to protect adults over 70. The State Department of Health reported 1,911 cases today. That's a 14% increase from the previous week and a 34% increase from this time last month. Those numbers do not include positive at-home tests. There are currently 46 people hospitalized with COVID in the state. In a public health presentation today, the state's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, said most of them are over 70 years old.
So even if they're vaccinated and boosted, we still know that age is your number one risk factor for COVID and for severe COVID illness.
Zink said Alaskans over 70 and those living with older relatives should consider doing more to protect themselves against COVID. That could include masking in indoor public spaces, minimizing indoor gatherings, and opening windows to allow for more airflow. Next month, the FDA will review Moderna and Pfizer's authorization requests for their vaccines for kids under 5. Zink said kids are generally still at much lower risk of severe symptoms than older people.
And so while this is super exciting news, I don't want it to take away from grandma or grandpa getting that booster.
The latest rise in cases in the U.S. is driven by the newest Omicron variant, Zink said. Like other COVID waves, it appears to be making its way to Alaska more slowly than the Northeast.
And up here in the Pacific Northwest, we're kind of lagging behind a bit on that BA2.12.1 variant. So not quite seeing the same prevalence of that variant that they are seeing on the Northeast. And as these cases start to outcompete here, expect that slightly more transmissible.
A third set of free at-home COVID tests are now available at covidtests.gov. Zink emphasized that people with COVID symptoms should get PCR tests even if their at-home tests are negative. If you've been in close contact with an infected person and don't have symptoms, test 5 or more days after exposure. The department's next public health presentation is scheduled for September. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, low Yukon River salmon runs could mean a season without subsistence salmon fishing.
This is going to be a huge loss of food and traditional practice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
Alaska Senate President Peter Michicki says he will not seek re-election this year, citing a desire to spend more time with family. His announcement comes after the legislature last week ended its four-month regular session and a week before a candidate filing deadline. The Soldotna Republican says he has spent nearly 11 of the last 16 months away from his four daughters and wife. He says his family is his priority. Last year was marked by drawn-out budget fights and four special sessions. Michicki was first elected to the Senate in 2012 and was Senate president this year and last. Well, Alaska residents are increasingly frustrated over the high price of summer flights to the lower 48. A round-trip ticket from Anchorage to Seattle in July will easily put you out $1,000. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports on what's to blame.
Carrie Beth Barr, an aircraft mechanic who lives in the Mat-Su, has an unmissable trip to Omaha next week. She's visiting friends she served in the military with, who she hasn't seen in about 10 years. One of them is traveling from Australia to be there.
Normally, I can book the whole trip for about $700 or $800, I think. But I couldn't find anything like one way under $900.
Barr played around with different flight combinations using a mix of miles and money when she was booking about a month ago. She finally settled on a flight leaving Anchorage at 3 a.m. to save on cost.
It's just frustrating and really expensive. So I used almost all my miles. I had 100,000 miles and I used almost all of it just on that trip.
So if you're looking for a trend, the trend is fares are way up.
Scott McMurrin is an Alaska travel writer and author of the Alaska Travelgram newsletter. He says part of the reason fares feel high is that they've been unusually low for more than 2 years while the pandemic curbed plane travel.
And so now when you see $600 or $700 to Seattle, people, start coming out of their skin.
Just a few months ago, McMurrin was blogging about one-way flights from Anchorage to New York City that cost less than $100. Memorial Day weekend, flights from Anchorage to Seattle start around $400. That's one way. Coming back, McMurrin says travelers are looking at eye-popping fares that will set you back $800 to $1,000.
There's a lot of demand right now, so that's pushing up the prices. The price of gas is going through the roof. And so that's reflected also in the air prices.
An Alaska Airlines spokesperson said in an email, the company is seeing near pre-pandemic passenger demand. The company said a recent pilot shortage, which has resulted in a reduced flight schedule through June, is, quote, not a factor driving up fares. Delta Airlines, which also flies nonstop between Anchorage and Seattle, did not respond to a request for comment. While prices remain high, Barr, the aircraft mechanic, is rethinking the rest of her summer travel.
I'm supposed to go down to Texas in July, and I don't know if I'm really going to make that trip happen because I haven't even looked at tickets yet for that, but I know it's going to be insanely expensive.
McMurrin recommends taking advantage of Alaska Airlines companion fares and using up any miles you've got stashed until fuel prices and summer demand come down. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Last year, the Yukon River saw unprecedented low salmon runs, and similarly dismal runs are forecast for this year. That could mean another season with no subsistence salmon fishing. However, if subsistence salmon fishing is allowed, then new restrictions will take effect along much of the river, limiting who's eligible to fish. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Salmon is the primary subsistence food source for most Yukon River communities, and this year, any subsistence salmon fishing on the Yukon River looks unlikely.
From the fisherman's standpoint, this summer is going to be horrible.
Holly Carroll is the Yukon River Federal Fishery Manager.
You know, it's the second year in a row where there could potentially be no salmon fishing.
And not just in the summer because of low Chinook and summer chum runs, but also in the fall during the fall chum and coho runs.
And that's incredibly unusual on the Yukon. You know, normally our chum runs are in the millions. This is going to be a huge loss of food and traditional practice.
Last year, the Yukon River saw its lowest ever chum and coho runs and one of its lowest ever Chinook runs. To conserve what few salmon might return this year, two tribes, the Holy Cross Tribe and the Native Village of Eagle, along with two Yukon River residents, requested federal management of the Yukon River. The Federal Subsistence Board approved the request. As a result, the federal government will manage the Yukon River salmon fishery this summer within federal waters. And within these waters, only rural residents who live along the river will be allowed to fish for salmon.
We are managing these runs to preserve them for sustainable uses, but also to preserve cultural practice and for subsistence priority.
Similar regulations have existed in the federal waters of the Lower Kuskokwim River for nearly a decade, but this is the first time subsistence salmon harvest within the Yukon River federal waters will be limited to local users. That is, if subsistence harvest is even allowed.
The runs are so poor that we would have to see the runs come in at the top of the projection for either Chinook or summer chum to allow any targeted salmon fishing.
To allow this fishing, the runs would first need to indicate that there are enough salmon to meet escapement goals, both for the state's goals and for the treaty goals with Canada. Carol says that information won't begin to clarify until at least the midpoint of the Chinook run in the lower river, usually around June 24th. It's customary for people who grew up in the region or have ties to the region and have moved away to return to fish for salmon with their families. But if fishing opens, this would be different this summer. Only permanent rural residents can fish for salmon in these federal waters. This restriction will not apply to state waters. Any Alaska resident can fish in state waters if the river opens to subsistence. And that's a big if. With subsistence fishing in question, sport and commercial fishing for salmon will not be allowed on the Yukon River this year. Under federal and state law, subsistence is the first harvest priority. Because there might be no salmon fishing, Carol is planning to allow for abundant fishing for non-salmon species, and there are a lot of them.
Sheafish, we have many types of whitefish, so humpback, round, broad whitefish. There's cisco, there's least and bearing cisco, there's burbot, there's pike. Some people will rod and reel for grayling.
This fishing for non-salmon will be allowed to all state residents using 4-inch mesh gill nets 60 feet in length. For KYUK, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Alaska employers, did you know there is a no-cost, no-deductible way to bond at-risk employees, including ex-offenders and individuals recovering from drug addictions, even when your own insurer will not provide bonding? Information about Fidelity Bonding is available at your local Alaska Job Center or toll-free at 877-724-2539. Fidelity Bonding through the Alaska Department of Labor is 100% federally funded. This is an equal opportunity program. This message sponsored by the Department of Labor.
Two years after becoming one of the most sealed-off locations in the United States, St. Paul Island is reopening to visitors. The Alaska Beacon reports St. Paul Island Tour, a business within the Yunungan-owned TDX Corp., is resuming its operations after a pause forced by the COVID-19 pandemic. Though distant from any of North America's big human population centers, St. Paul and the four other Pribilof Islands are at the center of the Bering Sea ecosystem and are teeming with marine mammals. The island is considered a premier destination for devoted birders. More than 300 species have been identified there, some of Asian origin and seldom spotted in North America. St. Paul is also the breeding site for more than half of the world's northern fur seal population, and it holds a large concentration of endangered Steller sea lions. Because of its remote location and sparse medical services, St. Paul maintained some of the nation's strictest COVID rules from the start of the pandemic, with tight limits on air travel. In all, St. Paul wound up with 57 confirmed COVID cases, according to the city government, a much lower rate than that for the state as a whole. A Maine-based renewable energy company with plans to build a tidal generator in Nikiski is now eyeing a second tidal site. Ocean Renewable Power Company hopes it can harness the strong tides in the inlet to power machinery at Port McKenzie across Knik Arm from Anchorage. It wouldn't be the first time the company is using tides to create power in Alaska. It has a freshwater hydrokinetic generator in Igiagig on the Alaska Peninsula. But it would be the first generator in saltwater in Alaska. KDLL Sabine Pooks has more.
Merrick Jakinski works with ORPC from Anchorage, and he says the project could fully power the machine that keeps the dock at Port McKenzie from corroding into Cook Inlet. That device is called a cathodic protection system.
Us potentially being able to be the power source for that could help make their dock mostly a sustainable system.
Saltwater poses its own challenges for tidal technology, but the mechanisms are generally similar to those the company already uses in Igiagig. As the tides move in and out, they'll spin turbines connected to an underwater generator. The tidal technology on the whole is still years behind its solar and wind counterparts, but the idea is it's more dependable, since tides are predictable hundreds of years in advance. Jakinski says they looked at Port McKenzie as a project site a while ago, but at that time, there wasn't a whole lot of information about the Cook Inlet belugas in the upper inlet. That's why the company turned its focus to the Nikiski site. But since then, there's been more research about the belugas there and more interest in renewables from the Matanuska-Sisitna Borough, which owns the port.
And so we saw it as a good fit going forward to explore a potential secondary use for Port McKenzie, because, as you may know, they have somewhat limited economical benefit to the borough at this point in time.
Port McKenzie doesn't bring in much revenue for the borough, according to a 2021 business development report. Further down the inlet, ORPC is wrapping up year one of its four-year preliminary permit for the project in Nikiski at the East Forelands. It's starting an environmental review of that site this summer. Jakinski says they'll study how any tidal tech at the Nikiski site could impact fish and belugas that spend time there.
So we're going to be working actively this summer to kind of pull together what we can, what we know about belugas to kind of inform our way forward. And then we'll come up with a strategy around what we want to implement to make sure that we're not having an impact on the beluga whale population in Cook Inlet.
That project would be much bigger than the Port McKenzie project, and it'll take time before any power is harnessed. But in 3 years, the company hopes to have a pilot device in the water as a test. Recent studies show the site would likely be an ideal spot for a generator. Then it plans to sell power to Homer Electric Association. The two companies signed a joint development agreement last year. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Klawak Hinya Corp is partnering with Huna Totem Corp to bring larger cruise ships to the community of Klawak on the west side of Prince of Wales Island. Mary Edenshaw is Chief Operations Officer for Klawak Hinya, the village native corporation for Klawak. She says small cruise ships have docked at the city float previously. The larger ships will tie up at an existing dock on Klawak Island owned by Klawak Hinya.
It was used in the past for export logs, and the huge log ships that would come in, they would dock there. And so we're going to convert that into a cruise dock port.
She says Huna Totem Corp reached out to Klawak Hinya wanting to add the community as a destination along the lines of Icy Strait Point in Huna, which Huna Totem also owns. Edenshaw says the plan is to start out small with ships that carry between 500 and 700 passengers.
This is going to be a process to, you know, include larger vessels later on down the road, but we will build a float that will attach to the existing structure that we have right now.
She says some cruise lines have already agreed to add Klawak to future itineraries, but because plans are still under development, Edenshaw did not give additional details other than that the first ships will arrive in Klawak in summer 2023. A Sitka organization is working with the Alaska Energy Authority to install a mostly federally funded electric vehicle charger in the community. but figuring out where to put it is a complicated problem. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka is an electric vehicle town. In pure numbers, it's a national leader.
If you were your own state, you would be beating California right now in terms of EV adoption.
That's Devin Kibbe, an electrical engineer and the founder of the Alaska Electric Vehicle Association, a nonprofit all-volunteer advocacy organization for electric cars, trucks, and buses. Kibbe said that based on the latest data from the Division of Motor Vehicles, Sitka had 126 electric vehicles, 90% of them Nissan Leafs. That's 15 Nissan Leafs for every 1,000 people in Sitka. Elsewhere in the state, that number drops down to around 2. But there isn't a single public charging station. Barb Bingham said the community had unique characteristics that made electric vehicles attractive for many residents.
With 14 miles of highway, you know, we're in a unique position to have short-range vehicles. Most of us trickle charge, I believe, and so it would be nice to be able to do a fast charge once in a while.
Bingham was one of the co-hosts of a presentation organized by Transition Sitka on May 23rd to hear from Kibbe about his work advocating for Juneau's 19 public charging stations. Kibbe bought a Leaf in 2014 and said he was okay charging it at home overnight from a regular electrical outlet. But as Juneau's population of electric vehicles grew, so did the need for public infrastructure.
Sometimes my car doesn't get plugged in at night. I forget. And I drive away in the morning and I go, oh no. And if I need it, I know that those chargers are there.
80% of the cost of Sitka's first ever public charging station will be covered by the Alaska Energy Authority, which is passing through funding from the federal infrastructure bill to install public charging stations along every 50 miles of national highway in the state. That qualifies Sitka for exactly one charger. Now it's a matter of figuring out where to put it. The site must have access to power, obviously, and if it's on private property, it will require the cooperation of landowners. What likely won't be needed, however, is any high-tech networking equipment or credit card readers. Kibbe said that the best value has proven to be charging cars for free.
When people plug into these level twos for an hour, the cost to charge for the electricity is, you know, like a couple dollars at most. And we found in the beginning that the cost to charge someone a few dollars exceeded the cost of electricity itself.
Kibbe urged Sitkins to consider what they wanted to accomplish with the charging station. Is it going to charge personal light-duty vehicles or allow the electrification of some commercial fleet? Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Tosh Kimmel and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kavitha George in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Maria Dudzek in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well, then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.